and welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A new podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas
of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is
produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based
nonprofit organization
supporting the development and use
of open education globally.
Learn more about us
at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at a global level.
We hope to bring you closer
to how open education is working
by hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you
to a global open educator,
and we invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
There's a recording in progress, and that's because we're here for another podcast episode of OEG Voices. I'm Alan Levine, and I get to push the buttons here, but we're really excited to be talking to an award winner from last year, our ongoing effort to sort of bring to attention people who previously have won awards because, well, they deserve even more recognition. And the fact that we're coming out pretty soon with this year's award categories. And so I've been really excited to do this one with Nick Sangstaken. Did I mispronounce that again, Nick?
Nick Sangstaken.
Sangstaken. I told you I would mispronounce it. And so just a quick hello to colleagues Paul Stacey and Marcelo Morales. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
Very nice to be here.
And so there's, I know probably everybody has lots of things we'd like to talk about, but so important that we recognize students within these awards and a little bit like, because we ask you to speak for all students, but I'm sure you've come across this before. But tell us a little bit about where you are in the world and the work you're doing now, and then we'll go back to talk about the award that you got.
Yeah, of course. So Nick Sangstaken, very, very happy to be here. Thank you for having me, and thank you for giving students who advocate for OER a voice and a platform to kind of to continue advocating. So thank you. My name is Nick Sangstaken. I'm the program coordinator for operational excellence and strategic initiatives at UNC Chapel Hill. I graduated from UNC during May of 2020. So essentially, I like to say I went on spring break and then never left. I stuck around originally as a Chancellor's Fellow, spent a year kind of just getting to understand the institution. I was always one of those people where I spent my undergrad kind of knocking on South Building, which is our main administrative building, and really kind of being an advocate and trying to make change at my university. And when it hit, I realized that I had a tremendous opportunity to kind of do something different. I didn't feel like it was the time to go to grad school, didn't feel like it was the time to really to move because I was going to be on Zoom anyway. So I thought, why not stick around and really kind of see how the sausage is made, for kind of a lack of a better metaphor, and really understand how the institution works, because I've been advocating for so long and knocking on that door. So I stuck around, got to work on a number of really cool projects, including Class Features, which was a course marking program at Carolina. So we actually were able to include, basically, it's basically an open syllabi repository, and then a course marking kind of almost CTC type zero textbook cost indicator marking system as well. So a great win for the university, got to work on that. And now I work in our operations division of the provost office, kind of helping with COVID testing sites and our Carolina Tech Ambassador program and kind of everything else in between. So I do a lot of different things for the provost office and for the chancellor's office here in our main administrative space. But it's been a journey, and again, happy to be here. I know it's a long-winded answer, but happy to take questions.
No, there's a lot to cover there, especially, I think it's so commendable that you, you took your undergraduate opportunity, developed this advocacy role, and now you're in a position to make that change. So what's been that flip like to go from student to sort of university employee?
It's been exciting. It's one of those things where what I found is, I think as a student, one thing we forget is that, first of all, I forgot that, oh my God, there's people who actually do this for a living, who care about students and who want to make this change. And what I think I've realized is everyone around me in the provost office here, they really want to see this place continue to thrive and to move forward and build and be better. So moving into that space, I've realized that. But I've also been very thankful and fortunate to be given some tools to really kind of take things and run with them. So I'm currently in the process of submitting a proposal for an OER grant on our campus, a pilot to reinstate what we had with a much larger budget, which would be really, really cool. So it's been great to be able to kind of have people put some trust in me and be able to go and just get things done. And also bring in a student perspective. I'm not a student anymore, and I know that. And so it's really great to be able to go back to folks who I went to school with, or kind of the new crop who are now rising up through the ranks, and say, hey, what do y'all need? What do you want? And kind of be that bridge. And so it's been really exciting in that way. But again, kind of a weird thing too, because I never really got that graduation. I never really, I feel like I never stopped being a student. I'm just here in just a different room. So
that's great. So I guess, you know, part of it, like, I'm interested to know, like, were you like always like had this advocacy bent to, like, were you the kid out there like canvassing the neighborhood and like protesting the street corner signs? And then what was your calling to OERs, and what was your call to awareness, especially on textbook affordability?
Yeah. So for the first part of that question, I've always been, honestly, like, I was the shy kid. I'm a music major. I was a music major. I'm a jazz saxonist. So I was always the shy kid who got up and played on stage. And that was what kind of brought me out of my shell. And I was really that way when I got to Carolina. And I got forced into this advocacy role because I've always had a passion for politics, and I was an Eagle Scout too. So I believe in doing the right thing. And I think in 2016, that was something that a lot of people found themselves really kind of wanting to protect and wanting to stand for better values and for kind of these principles that we all hold dear. And so I kind of got looped into voter registration work through NC Perg on campus. And I started doing that, and I loved it. And it was a great opportunity to kind of, almost like I was on stage with music, be pushed out into this world where I had to interact. There's no standing behind your clipboard. You're out there in what we call our pit, which is our main kind of thoroughfare on campus. And I had to kind of talk to people, and it was fun. It pushed me out of my comfort zone. And so I did that for a little while. And then when the election was over, there wasn't any more registration. So I'm like, okay, I'll pack my bag up. I'm gonna go back to the music building. And there was this little struggling campaign at the time within our NC Perg chapter, or called the Textbook Affordability Campaign. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, that seems cool. I've always had a passion for education. My grandmother was one of the first cohorts of women to go to Stanford University, and so she always kind of instilled that in us, that education matters and it has an impact. And I was a public policy student too, so I got to see the numbers behind that. And so I'm like, oh, that's a cool idea. It aligns with those principles that I went into this kind of voter registration work, and it aligns with those principles. And so why not try it out? And then the person who was leading that campaign left, and people were kind of just looking around and saying, who's going to lead this? I knew nothing about OERs. I knew nothing about any of this stuff. And I just kind of, I guess I got pushed out in front first. And here I was, as a sophomore, I didn't really know much about this, and I had to learn. And what I found is the more I learned about OER and the more I learned about textbook affordability and just really the affordability crisis within higher education, the more I was intrigued, but more of the more I was, I felt like I had to get involved, because it's one of those things where it gets worse and worse every year. And we see the same problems continue to perpetuate themselves and snowball. And so I saw a lot of opportunity, and I saw a lot of places where students could get involved where they hadn't been. Kind of that's how I landed in OER. From there, I kept snowballing, and I saw that there's all these connections. If we just switch to something that's more equitable, more accessible, look how many more people we can bring to the table. Look how many less barriers we can have for our students. The more I looked into OER, the more passion I got about it, and the more I realized this is what we need to be doing, not just as an institution, but as a society. If we go open, we're really just making things better. No one ever loses anything by having more information. And so, very long-winded answer, but that's kind of my story there.
Don't apologize. And there's no right answers in that too. So like, you know, and probably, you know, all of us have, like, I remember being irate at $130, which is now cheap for a chemistry book, But like, I didn't feel like I could do anything about that. It was like the game was rigged. How things like progressed from the time you started your advocacy role to where we are now? Because like, you know, the publishers are doing some adjusting. They're trying to sell, you know, these add-on homework packages. And now there's like proctoring software to fight. And so is it, has there been achievements? And like, what are the looming things to take on?
Yeah, the short answer is things have changed. And I think in just the short amount of time I've been involved, we've kind of seen this massive industry shift of really what, it's a different game than it was when we started. When we started, it was just, let's move away from that $500 textbook, which, by the way, I've had. I had a music textbook that was $500. The guy who wrote it was in the department. And we actually, side note, a bunch of students actually got together and convinced them to not use that book anymore. But our battle then was, let's move away from these $500 textbooks to a different textbook that's in print. It wasn't the access code battle. And it certainly wasn't inclusive access and automatic billing and all that. And so what I've seen is, and it was planned. It was something that was kind of coming. We saw coming, but it's a shift away from the types of products that have half-lives. It's a movement from the publishers to kind of destroy the buyback market, the secondary market, and anything that's going to kind of take them out of the equation. And that's why you see some really interesting coalitions of bookstores even kind of getting on what I would say is the right side of things. Again, I started out pushing for OERs and cheaper print, and then I found myself fighting against inclusive access. And then that's what took me to DOJ and to kind of all the, I mean, I've advocated against automatic billing at this campus, at Central Florida, at UNC Pembroke, and then, of course, on the national level against Cengage Bora. So it's a completely different market. It's a completely different world. It's one that's trying to be digital, even though I don't think that's what students want. I think students want choices. They don't want to be told you need to buy this this access code, which is also going to be 10% of your grade. It's a movement towards those products and policies that promote profit margins rather than the interest of students. So,
can you say more about the built-in billing? What, you know, that's, I think a lot of people may not, I mean, they probably are aware of it, but maybe they're just not aware of the extent of it. Like,
and I think one of the reasons why, so kind of for context, inclusive access or automatic billing is just that. It's the automatic billing of textbooks to a student's account, which means that when you enroll, you're also billing straight for in a course material, meaning, and there are opt-in versus opt-out systems that it gets more nuanced than that. But in short, it's you're enrolling in a class and you're going to get billed for the textbook, which takes the choice out of the equation. So that means that you can't even go look on Amazon anymore. You can't go look at Chegg. You can't look for an alternative. It's just you're going with whatever is in the system. Again, that can change versus with an opt-in versus an opt-out. But that is really a different animal because it's taking the choice away, and it's not really best for students or instructors, because when we think about these kind of automatically opting in programs, especially those that are connected to kind of textbook publisher libraries, you're basically creating what I would call is the equivalent of like a Nike or an undergraduate or a, not undergraduate, sorry, an Under Armour school with textbook companies, and that's just not the way to go. We don't need Cengage or Pearson schools. We need an option where students can choose the kind of whether something's in print, whether it's digital, where they can choose how they pay for it, whether it's with financial aid or with a credit card. Those have that as implications, but also for faculty, they should be able to choose kind of beyond one library or one mode of delivery.
How extensive is that?
It's fairly extensive. It's where you can go to the Cengage CEO's Twitter handle and you can see that he's very explicit that this is the direction he wants to go in. I assisted USPIRG with a report 2 years ago now. I have to add a year with COVID. They're popping up everywhere. And that's because this is the publisher's kind of first priority. And it was named in the failed Cengage McGraw merger that they stated very clearly that this is where they want to go because it does exactly what all the publishers have been saying they want to do for years, which is it completely gets rid of the secondary market. It completely gets rid of buyback markets and used books. And so it's an automatic check for them.
But someone's signing off on that. Like someone's approving of that in an office, not like yours, but in university offices, right?
Yes. And so this is a problem with administrations and with kind of how these larger contracts are signed with the publishers and with the bookstores, where the people who are aware of the problems, which isn't a lot of folks, unfortunately, they're not at the table. And for most of these deals too, students are at the table. So if you're an administrator and you hear inclusive access, that sounds wonderful. Who would want a greater access to a book and something that's inclusive? That sounds great. But at the end of the day, it's neither inclusive nor does it increase access. It just automatically builds your textbook. So it's the reading into the contracts and the deals that doesn't happen. And I don't blame these administrators, because they wouldn't know. How would they know? And I think that's why it's so important that for all these discussions, students get looped in, that librarians get looped in, that it's not just someone who is in a building like this. And I think too often we forget why we're here, especially in admin. We forget why we're here, and it's to serve our students and to serve our institution and the research enterprise and really everything that we're aiming to do. And we can't do that unless every constituency is here.
I think that has my vote for the worst use of inclusive, but I want to give, I've been like hogging the microphone here. I know Paul and Marcella have a lot of things they'd like to ask too.
Now, if I could just jump in with a question that was intriguing me ever since I read your co-authoring of the UNC textbook pledge. And I know it's more or less in line with what you're saying. And I wonder, how did that come to be? And what has happened since then? Because I know that you co-authored it in 2017.
Yeah. That pledge actually kind of came out of nowhere. It was almost an accident, where we were looking at ways to really kind of engage faculty with kind of our textbook affordability campaign and the work we were doing. We had heard that there were some folks in student government who were looking to do the same thing, and then kind of a pledge happened. So we're like, what if we actually partner with these with faculty and create a relationship that's ongoing, similar to other initiatives that had gone on our campus. And so we drafted really a pledge that would look at what are the principles, if we want to have partners, what are the principles we want them to believe in? Very easily attainable goals, and just kind of being open with what your textbook is, sharing good principles or best practices, just really simple things that everyone should be able to do, and that everyone hopefully would already be doing, we hope. And so we wrote the pledge, and very quickly, I think we're almost up to 400 partners, which was one of the, it ended up becoming one of the largest pledges of its kind in the country. And through that, we were able to really grow and create these partnerships and actually go back and first look into like, what was your first book you were using? Make recommendations on other things that could be adopting. In many cases, there was no ER pitch there. And then kind of after the fact, going back and discussing, saying, how did this work? What are you hearing from your students? How can we help? So we were able to do that. And Alan, to your question, which I realized I forgot this part of the answer earlier, but kind of how do we grow with that? And when we started the textbook pledge, the average cost of materials at Carolina was about $1,600. It was like $1,604. When I graduated, it was down to 972. So I'm not taking all the credit for that. There are tons of other factors, but I think it's one of those things where kind of creating these long-lasting relationships allowed us to kind of be a part of the change, but not kind of have a shock factor. It's really hard for faculty to just immediately make the switch to OER. Sometimes they need to move from an access code to a print material to another print material. It's a long step, because I realize that when you're an undergrad, 4 years is not a long time. And some of these faculty members have been here for 40 years. So we can't just expect them to change their whole teaching pedagogy in 2 seconds. And so creating that long lasting relationship that we could then pass down to the folks who replaced us worked really well. And it was also just kind of helped create more of a narrative on campus too.
I think that the whole issue around reducing textbook costs and making education more affordable for students, that's like been a really high value proposition associated with open education for quite some time. But I know that you're sort of really immersed in it now. And I wonder if you kind of have a kind of bigger picture of what more beyond just textbook affordability you could imagine open education entailing, and whether there are projects or initiatives that you're currently involved in that are moving in a kind of expanded vision of what open education can enable?
The first thing I'll start with, I think if we've learned anything over the last year, it's that the world is a lot smaller than we make it out to be. And I think this call is a great example of that. And so one of the things I've always loved with OER is, no pun intended, but how open it is, how you can work with someone halfway around the world, how you can share your materials with a classroom halfway around the world and benefit not only your students, but thousands more and millions more if we do our player game right. And so for me, that's the big thing. And so when I look at kind of how we can move forward, it's learning from that and really kind of taking these principles into other aspects of the university. So there's no reason we should have paywalls for most things. If we have information, let's share it. If we have best practices on everything from kind of, I don't know, how we do an executive search to how we run our COVID testing labs, let's share those best practices. Let's work together. I mean, there are too many times where, like for UNC, for example, we're here in the Triangle in North Carolina. We have Duke University and NC State down the road. We don't share with them enough. And if we're not sharing with them enough, then how can we connect with UCLA, with UT Austin, all the other great universities in this country and then beyond? So I think that's the biggest thing that I hope to learn. One thing I've learned from OER and more of learned from the advocacy of OER of just things to look for and things I'm worried about is kind of the lack of concern for privacy for students. Unfortunately, when you talk about OER, you also have to talk about access codes and what's going on with the textbook market. And we saw kind of a laissez-faire handling of student data with access codes and with inclusive access. And the same things right now is happening with proctoring and Proctorio and all these things, where not only do they disproportionately impact students of color and negatively impact students of color, as do access codes, but they fail to recognize the basic rights that our students have. And so I think whenever we look at these projects that are along, I think to do it from an open perspective is just more than being kind of open in terms of the copyright meaning. It's more of how do we be open, accessible? How do we put those morals, those principles I mentioned previously, how do we put those first?
But again, like I'm thinking like as a student, you may not even recognize that your teachers have made use of OER. So it's a little bit like, how do they don't necessarily see that as an advantage. And I go back to a conversation I had with a physics instructor long ago, and he just talked about like, when he's using publisher content, like it's fine, he uses it. But when he's responsible for shaping it and he has a stake in it, David said his whole energy with his teaching changed, and he was highly energetic already. So I don't even know I believe that as a benefit, but then again, students might not see that directly. So I kind of wonder, like, again, speaking for all students everywhere, but just like, can you give us any insights as to how students even see these issues outside of the affordability, which is important, absolutely, in the access?
So first of all, I'll start with when I used to kind of describe OERs, I would always say that they're of the same or greater quality as a traditional book. And it's for that customization aspect of it. The fact that we can tailor a course to a book, or a book to a course rather, than the other way around. And so that's how I always talk about it. And I think that's how, like, that to me is the future of education. And so I think, first of all, in terms of how we engage students and how we get them to understand this, it's whenever faculty are using these books, it's making a point to say, just so you know, this book, it's not just a waste of time anymore. It's not that traditional textbooks are a waste of time, but it's not just something that I thought of second. Every lecture is perfectly tailored and vice versa with the book to make sure that this is the best experience for you. And so I think if we actually make a point to say these things, then we can make a big impact. And then students, I think, feel better, because unfortunately students, they've been, and we all were, you just kind of get into the status quo of I'm going to start the semester by going to the bookstore, by purchasing my books. I'm not going to look at the price because it doesn't matter, because I have to buy it anyway. That cycle of just kind of the monotonous status quo, that's what the publishers want. That's kind of their whole game. It's making it normal. I mean, that's why we see like not a publisher, but Barnes & Noble, our bookstore on campus, and same thing with Follett. Their first day program normalizes going and basically blindly purchasing books. So I think when we present the alternative to that, either as a faculty or as administrators, we can kind of bring students into this conversation in a different way, in a way that they should have from the beginning, and have them be part of the change. Because I think one of the issues too with OER that we see, I apologize, I always get too many emails during all these things.
We know how busy you are.
Shut up. I think unfortunately people forget that OER still has a long way to go to match certain quality aspects of traditional textbooks. And so if we can be upfront about that with students and say, hey, I know this doesn't look as pretty as this, but the information is going to be a lot more tailored to what you're learning. It's going to save you a lot of money. It's going to be more accessible for you in terms of all that and how you want to read it and everything. This is a good thing. So if we can have that conversation, everyone's just going to be better off. Again, I hope that answered your question.
I've got a really kind of difficult question that I've been trying to think through myself, Nick, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this. And that is there a kind of opportunity or possibility even for the open education community to work with publishers? Some publishers are in a sense like, we would say, you know, they're exploiting OER, they're undermining the open education community, but some seem to be actually trying to find some way of engaging with open education while still operating a for-profit company. Is there a kind of place there that there's some mediation, or is it going to be the clash of the titans?
That's a very difficult question. And I think I've probably always been more on the side of, well, I'm skeptical. I don't know. I never want to say people shouldn't work together. I'm originally from New Hampshire. I grew up in a town where it was like, you got to a stoplight and everyone said, no, you go first. So I feel like I want to be the nice person here and say, we need to work together. But I think it's one of those things where it needs to be a very thoughtful relationship. And with that being said, I think OER right now can do a great job with introduction, kind of those one-on-one courses. I would say like 100 through 200 or 300 level courses,
yeah.
Intro courses through the mid to moderate. The really specific kind of joke, like, whale watching 439 or whatever, that probably isn't going to have a great up-to-date OER. And so I think that's where we can have that partnership. And I think, again, if the conditions are right and it's one where students are still going to kind of have unfettered access to a material that can be shared and customized, if we can still promote open principles, then it's a relationship I think I'd be comfortable with. But I'm skeptical just from where we've been. This problem was entirely engineered by these companies. We were leading to a duopoly in the market, and we're at an oligopoly because of what they did. And so it's really hard to believe that they could be part of the change after 40 years. So again, skeptical, but I hope everyone can just get along. That's my answer.
Have you ever gotten... Oh, go ahead, Marcella.
No, please go ahead.
No, you first. We're in New Hampshire. Come on, you first.
You first.
I'm looking at this intersection here in the middle of the screen. That's New Hampshire. Come on.
No, I was just wondering. It's such a pleasure to listen to you speak, Nick, definitely. And I'm just wondering, what's going to be next for you? Where will we see Nick in 5 years or 10 years? Is open going to be part of your life, I think?
I truly hope so. It's one of those things where I see a ton of potential here. And to me, it's fascinating and how we can truly increase equity and access in higher ed and in all education. But I think in this country, we're seeing that higher ed is something we need to focus on. And it's something that we need to increase access to, especially in minoritized and marginalized communities. And so it's something I hope can be involved in. I'd love to eventually be on the research side of things and really see what is the impact of OER in the classroom and on student outcomes, beyond just affordability kind of victories. So the goal right now, in short, is to looking into education policy, graduate programs, PhD programs. There's one here at Carolina. So hopefully this age as well. And I'll be there soon. And then stay in the higher ed space. It's one of those things where it's been really exciting being on the other side and being able to be part of the change. Kind of beyond Zoom meetings, keeping up the fight and trying to make at least this campus more open for our students.
I would guess that UNC would like you to stay around.
Please do.
Go, Nick, go.
Yeah.
Have you, I mean, because you're involved in a lot of these public and breaking up the monopoly attempt, I mean, have you gotten any like heat or negative, I don't want to say like whatever, things from the publishers? Have they come back to you like behind the scenes and say like, what are you doing? Are you wrong? Or
There have been a couple of that's not true, which it was. You know what I'm saying? There have been a couple. I think it's really telling when people don't rebut certain things because they know what kind of, especially at the time with Cengage McGraw, the stuff we were talking about was straight out of, I mean, I presented a contract from Cape Fear Community College to the Department of Justice, which detailed publicity clauses in inclusive access contracts. Basically, there were clauses that prevented the institution from talking about the program. So everything had to go through the publishers, which obviously presents some issues. And that was never refuted. And the intent of that was never refuted. The use of those were never refuted. And so to answer your question, not really that much heat. There are a couple things, but it was one of those things where I think that's one of the best parts of you when you know you're advocating for something that's truly just and that should be implemented, when you get a lot of keep up the fight stuff.
That's good. I mean, there have been like the proctoring companies that have gone after students has just been repugnant to say the least. And so maybe the publishers have a little bit more class. I don't know.
Well, can we keep that in? I don't know.
what might you say, like maybe to other students who maybe should be considered for this recognition that you got as a student award for OER?
I think the biggest thing I'd say to my peers and to everyone who's still fighting for this is, first of all, it takes a while. It's unfortunately in OER, it's a long term game, and it's one of those things where I talked about the course marking program we enacted at Carolina called Class Features at the beginning of this. And that whole project started 4 or 5 years ago. And for the people who are on the open syllabi kind of side of that, way, way, way before this, so probably 10, 15 years ago. So these things take a long time, but when you finally get a win, when you're able to stop a merger, when you're able to kind of, I don't know, get an OER grant or reach a milestone on your textbook pledge, that feeling of just knowing that you're standing up for all those who come after you is truly the best feeling in the world. And it means so much. And so all this work, it's seen and it's incredibly valuable. And I mean, I've folks who I've kind of kept in touch with who were in my campaign for NC PIRG when I first started, and their work is still, they're keeping it going. And it's so important that they do that. More importantly, I think it's especially students of color and students from marginalized communities. It's so important that they get involved in this work at institutions that aren't just kind of major flagships. I like to say all the time, like the community colleges and kind of smaller state schools, they're the ones who have made the most change on OER, especially in the United States. And so if they come up with an idea, roll with it, you know, and convince us to go talk to your peers at larger schools. They are the people who can really make a lot of change. So again, also, so that's what I'd tell them, and just keeping up the fight. But I think in terms of kind of the next award recipients, I hope that, and especially for OE Global, that we look beyond the United States and that we look to those smaller places where the change is happening in remarkable places. I was really fortunate to write for the OER Digest, which for all 15 readers out there, thank you. So I did that for a little while, and it was really remarkable searching for stories around the world, and there's a lot of really cool stuff happening outside the United States, inspires me a tremendous bit. So I hope to see more of that. I hope to learn more about it. And
okay, now a serious question. Do you get still time to play saxophone?
I try.
I did find a video, but it's 2017. So what's your favorite set? Are you jazz? Are you fusion? Are you
I worry about. Hopefully, no one who's watching this goes and looks for that video. It's really, really bad. I swear I'm better than that now. I'm a jazz player, and about my sophomore and junior year of undergrad, I fell in love with composition. So I started writing my own tunes, and then before the pandemic, I was scheduled to go into the studio in March of what was that? I guess 2020. To record a record, which was great timing. So that didn't happen. So kind of planning to do that towards the end of this year. And then I have a concert to unveil a record with all my stuff and with a bunch of my friends and colleagues in October. So I do still try to play. It's not as easy as it once was, but it keeps me sane. It's a lot of fun.
Very cool. Very cool.
Right.
I'm going to leave it to my colleagues to say anything else, but I really want to thank you, Nick, for tuning in with us. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, Nick. Yeah. You lifted our spirits. Definitely. Listening to you speak. Absolutely.
That's great.
We didn't even talk about COVID, but.
that's my whole job now is I would have never expected that the music major, as I majored in music, political science, and public policy during my time in undergrad. None of those were like hard sciences. Music, we counted to four most of the time. So to be involved in the COVID space has been incredible, and to learn about, to be in the science realm and to be learning about vaccines and efficacy of, I had a whole conversation the other day about the efficacy of certain types of masks. Like that is something I never expected I'd learn about. It's really been something. And on the open side, I think we've learned a lot. But I don't want to keep y'all too much. But thank you so much for the opportunity and for giving me this platform and for the award and for everything. It's truly thank you for everything you do and for highlighting this stuff around the world. Thank you.
Well, please stay close.
Yeah, let us know when that the music comes out. And because, you know, actually, if you open license some, we'll like use it into our outro music because maybe it's time to shift our stuff. But to let folks know, we publish this at Open Education Global at OEG Voices is our podcast, and it's at voices.oeglobal.org. And we also link it to our community, Connect, where you can actually interact and ask follow-up questions with Nick. And when this does go into the podcast, there's a little bit of music called Joyful Meeting. And that's been working for, it's good to have some laughter here and camaraderie. And we just really appreciate your candor and your energy, Nick.
Thank you all so much.